Hi, I'm Anne Strandchamps, and today I'm asking you for your most valuable resource, your attention.
Attention, Kmart shoppers!
Attention! Oh, attention must be paid. Attention must be paid.
Intrusive advertising is just the tip of a larger cultural iceberg. It's hard to open a newspaper or a magazine these days without reading a complaint about our fractured mental lives, diminished attention spans, and a widespread sense of distraction. Often the occasion for such a story is some new neuroscience finding about how our brains are being rewired by our habits of information grazing and electronic stimulation. It is clear that attention has also become an acute collective problem of modern life, a cultural problem.
So here's what it's like to live in an attention economy. From the moment you wake up until the time you go to bed, you're bombarded by viral videos, news alerts, things trending on Facebook, exploding on Twitter, and popping up everywhere. On top of everything are the ads. So how does it feel to know that the commodity everyone wants is inside your skull? Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll focus our attention on attention. We'll find out how attention merchants are capturing our most valuable resource and reselling it to advertisers. But first, what's the perfect drug for a culture of distraction? Adderall. Sales of the prescription stimulant have increased exponentially, and not always legally, especially to young adults. Casey Schwartz spent her 20s gulping down prescription stimulants to help her get through school and start her career, and she wrote about it in a story for the New York Times Magazine called Generation Adderall.
I took my first Adderall towards the beginning of college. A dear friend of mine had some, and I was telling her, I'm in a pickle because I have an essay due tomorrow on a book I have not begun reading yet. And she said, have you ever tried an Adderall? Someone gave them to me, but I don't like them because it makes me want to stay up doing cartwheels in the hallways all night.
And you thought, that sounds pretty good.
I thought that is the most fantastic description. Fork it over immediately. So she did. So that night was truly euphoric at the Brown University Library, just reading this book, writing this essay, feeling, you know, utterly inspired, like I'd tapped into something that I had never had access to before.
People say this, and I still don't understand what that must feel like. Okay, so what exactly does it feel like?
You feel a sense of intensity. You feel locked in. Everything else fades away. Nothing else really matters except the work at hand. And you don't feel tired. There's no threat that you are going to run out of energy. So I could just bear down with the full force of my attention on whatever the material was.
So no part of you thought, oh, my God, I'm so sick of this paper. I don't want to write this. Maybe I'll go stop by the cafeteria for a little bit.
Exactly. None of those diversions were appealing.
So when Adderall works like this, what exactly is Adderall doing in the brain? What are the changes that it's making that lets it have that effect and also that makes it addictive?
Well, like many addictive substances, Adderall unleashes like cascades of dopamine, which is the feel-good neurotransmitter associated with all kinds of things that feel good.
It's
not
the reward.
Just drugs.
Reward.
It's the reward. It's
the
right? Right. So you can see that because when you're taking Adderall, these very dry things, you know, neuroscience textbooks, suddenly what you're reading in them become fascinating, literally rewarding in a way that they wouldn't be if you didn't have this sort of waterfall of dopamine like drenching your brain. So but what happens with any addiction or when you're chronically exposed to a substance like that, your brain tries to compensate, tries to maintain a kind of homeostasis by downregulating the actual dopamine receptors in your brain because it's too much. So it's trying to fight back in the opposite direction. And that becomes a very big problem the more time you spend on the drug.
So that at that point, in order to have any of that wonderful reward feeling that we get thanks to dopamine, you pretty much had to be taking Adderall. You know, just a cup of cocoa wouldn't cut it anymore.
No, that's true. Exactly. And that's why people have to continually up their dose of any substance that they're dependent on in order to get that same initial high.
Were you secretive about it? I mean, did you feel ashamed of what you were doing?
Yes. No one really knew the extent of what I was doing. And this despite the fact that I'm extremely close to my friends and family. People knew that I was on Adderall, sort of. But the extent to which this substance came to really control my life for 10 years, no one knew.
So at some point, you had a bad experience. I don't know if you'd call it an overdose, but something like that. What happened?
Yes. This was senior year, towards the end of the first semester. It was finals week in college. I had just taken just way too many pills, was barely sleeping, and I was in the library trying to finish a paper for my Russian history class. And I just all of a sudden the strangest sensation came over me where I just felt like I wasn't really in my body or in the room, like I was very divorced from reality. So it was so intense. I called my friend Dave and I said, I don't know what's happening, but I need you to come. It was blizzarding in Providence. And we wound up at the nearby hospital where it turned out I'd had a panic attack induced by amphetamines, which is actually not so uncommon for people who are taking Adderall.
Hmm. What were the doctors, the physicians, like? Did you feel like you picked up a sense of any scorn from them?
Definitely. I remember the doctor who treated me so well. He was probably in his early 30s, very attractive guy. It was like one of those New England blizzarding nights, probably 1 a.m. at this point. And he just looked at me with such, you know, skepticism and more incredulity than concern. And I was trying to sort of lighten the mood, but, you know, it just didn't, you know, it was such a striking encounter for me because I wasn't used to being treated or seen that way or seeing that expression on people's faces when they were dealing with me.
No, here you were a student at Brown University. You'd probably been upwardly mobile your entire life. And suddenly you get an authority figure looking at you like you're scum.
Yeah. Or just you're a wreck, you know, was the implication. I remember I was on the phone with my father a couple of days later. You know, I told him about what had happened. And I said, you know, God, this doctor was just looking at me like I was totally nuts. And I was expecting my dad to sort of be on my side. But what he actually said was, well, in fact, you were nuts. You were nuts for taking that number of pills.
What was it like to get off of it, like for the first few weeks? Because you described how dependent your brain gets. I suppose you had to go through a period of time when there were just no reward chemicals in your system anywhere, which I can't imagine.
Well, by that point, by the time I actually did manage to get off when I was 30, I had so internalized the reasons why I had to get off. And there truly were these instant consolations as well. And this feeling of sweetness that sort of seeped back into my life that I had been missing for years. This feeling of just being able to savor the day, savor a conversation, laugh with friends, not be in a frenzy, not be in an artificial rush. All of these things kicked in immediately and actually were so important in sustaining the not being on the Adderall.
So that's good.
Yes.
That's good to know. So I always think that the drugs that become kind of cult hits for a while, as Valium did in the 50s for a certain, you know, segment of women especially, as antidepressants did for my generation of college students, Prozac Nation, I think that those drugs become important to us because there's something profound going on culturally. And the drugs essentially are letting us cope with something dysfunctional about the culture at the time. Do you think that about Adderall?
100%. And that's so well put. The internet entered American life at almost the exact same time as Adderall did. This is the mid-90s. And that both have just exploded since. So they've just been perfect partners and proceeded in perfect lockstep for the last 20 years. And when you think about it, it actually makes total sense because the internet is a source of constant distraction. It sort of pixelates our attention spans. We all know it. We all feel it. And so we turn to these pills in an attempt to sort of patch ourselves back together.
And at the same time, I wonder if there is something about the quality of attention that Adderall gives you that somehow is also a version of the quality of attention required when you're on the internet, or that using the internet produces. Because we all know what that feels like, right? You get on meaning to look something up, and 60 minutes later, you're down some incredibly elaborate wormhole of floating from site to site to site. And there's something sort of blissful about that. I mean, does Adderall feel like that?
Totally. Yeah, because you're in a kind of twilight state. You're outside of normal life or something. But there's also something I never have found it blissful, to be honest. I always find it a little bit subtly sickening to be on those internet rabbit holes. And I feel like there's a shallowness to it that accords perfectly with the Adderall experience, where you think you're sort of plumbing the depths of something, but actually you've narrowed your vision down to an extreme.
Hmm. So what would you say to a high school kid or a college kid right now who's thinking about taking Adderall, who's worried that they can't keep up in college? They can't, and they look around and nobody else seems to be having problems. And their roommate says, here, try this.
Look, I mean, of course, I'm not a doctor, and there's been a lot of criticism of the piece saying, you know, how could I not legitimize ADHD? Well, it was not my intention to delegitimize it. But I would just say that it was not until I managed to get myself off Adderall that my life could really progress and that I could really start making strides towards any of the things that mattered to me. So that ultimately Adderall cost me so much and gave me very, very little.
What do you wish somebody had said to you besides
that?
I
wish someone had said, look, it's okay to be young, confused, and feel ineffectual and pointless and lost. It's totally okay. That's normal. It's even necessary. And don't skip that part. You have to feel that confusion in order to find your way to clarity. And being on a pill, by definition, you have obscured how you really feel about things and what you're really interested in, what you're really passionate in. You're not going to get there on this pill.
Casey Schwartz is a science journalist. Her story, Generation Adderall, appeared in a recent issue of the New York Times Magazine. She's also just written a book about the new science of neuropsychoanalysis. It's called In the Mind Fields. Coming up, meet the attention merchants, corporations and businesses that specialize in converting your attention into cash. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
What if I told you that there is an entire sector of the economy run by people who are working diligently to get inside your head and harvest your attention? Well, if that sounds kind of creepy, you know these guys. Call them the attention merchants. Anyone whose business model consists of attracting your attention and then reselling it for profit. Think ad-based TV channels, clickbait producers, celebrities, and of course the big social media companies, Facebook, Instagram, etc. Legal scholar Tim Wu is the author of The Attention Merchants, the epic scramble to get inside our heads. He told Steve Paulson, it is impossible to ignore this stuff.
You know, there are people who sort of think they're immune to advertising. They have this magical power to disregard it. Yet I think that charitably can be said to be fooling yourselves. But there's something more profound going on, which is the media, the things in our lives are designed to advertise to us. So, you know, television shows are written around the commercial break. Or, you know, the internet sites are designed to keep you clicking and clicking and clicking. Maybe you would prefer a different kind of experience, but the business model depends on you clicking. So everything in our life becomes warped so that we can be kind of presented on a silver platter for advertisers. There's no way to ignore this unless you live in the desert as a complete hermit. It affects your life very profoundly. Many of us, I think, feel it in the sense that, you know, we're always distracted. I don't know if you've had this experience. You sit down, you want to write an email. 4 hours go by, you've clicked on a thousand sites. You're just like,
yep.
A huge amount of our life now is becoming designed like a casino where you're meant to sort of just keep clicking away or watching away or something, sort of lose control of yourself and hours go by, which can cost you a lot in terms of what you really wanted to do, but it delivers marginal extra revenue. So the casino effect, I think, has a huge impact on our life and I think contributes to us feeling out of control.
Now, back in 1971, the economist Herbert Simon developed the idea of an attention economy, and he noticed this new phenomenon of information overload. And he pointed out that a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. So 45 years later, with the advent of the internet, we're well beyond a wealth of information, aren't we? It's more like a superabundance of information.
I mean, the dude was right. He saw it. And when I read that, I was like, holy cow, this guy could really see the future. You know, we're in a soup. And it has meant that for almost everything, you know, a new product, a new movie, a political campaign, everything begins with getting attention before the kind of competition on the merits. So it has, in some ways, attention become the currency of our times. It's one of the reasons celebrities are so valuable. You cannot do anything, get a cause started, without attaching a celebrity to it. So you at least get some attention to it, and then people can think, do I really want to give to these refugees or to this orphanage or something? You know, it's become, as he said, 45 years ago, the scarcest thing and therefore the most valuable thing.
So if we put this in some historical perspective, can you go back in history and sort of pick out who the first attention merchant was?
Yes. I name as the first attention merchant Benjamin Day, who was the founder of the New York Sun, which was the first newspaper to really make a go of selling itself for very cheap, was just a penny press, and attract a huge audience and resell them. The only problem with that model, it generated enormous audiences and was very successful, it's low price, is that Benjamin Day soon found that to compete, he had to run crazier, more lurid, more spectacular stories. And so with the rise of the first attention merchant came the first ethical questions as to what do you do to get attention, a problem which still haunts our present times.
So what kinds of stories did he run?
Well, you see, he began to face a competitor in the New York Herald, another newspaper which specialized in murder, mayhem, and other forms of violent crime. So his great stroke of genius was to begin basically making up stories. One of the most notable examples is he ran a long series of discoveries of what had been seen on the moon by the world's largest telescope. Among other things, he discovered man bats, who apparently were fond of fornication with each other, huge giant trees, and he just ran this as news. People went crazy. They're like, wow, that's what's on the moon? Incredible. never printed the retraction, never even hinted that it might have not been true. And so that sort of showed the early perils of journalism. If you have a business model that depends on attracting people, the race is almost always to the bottom.
And what you're saying is, I mean, the new business model here was, instead of the old thing of, you know, you make your money by the price of the subscription, here you're practically giving it away for free, but you're getting a massive amount of readers, and therefore, you know, through advertising, you can make your money.
That's the trick. And I want to say, in our times, since then until now, we have an incredible weakness for free stuff.
So one of the popular tricks for internet companies, or really any company on the web, is to get your attention through clickbait. Can you explain how this works?
You know, the currency of the realm is the click. And clickbait, which was invented early 2000s, is stuff which is only interested in the click and only interested then in making you share it later and not particularly interested in any other goal. When you think about what the media could be, it's frankly a pretty low goal. We want you to click, and maybe we want you to be so aroused or interested that you share. And it's like we have the greatest minds of our generation are working on those goals. And sometimes I think, like, oh my goodness, we really have wasted the last decade if that's what we're trying to do. But, you know, fortunes depend on that particular act. We used to think about the competition for ratings as being this incredibly degrading thing that force people to run the worst television. But the competition for clicks has made the competition for ratings look dignified in comparison. Because at least you had to, you know, have people sit there watching your television show. The click is just like a tiny microsecond of attention. It harnesses the lowest parts of the brain and is really sort of a degrading thing to aim for.
It does make you wonder if these people who are sort of the masters of clickbait are kind of, I don't know, they have a pipeline into the neuroscience of how our brains work and, you know, what we pay attention to.
I mean, I think they absolutely do, not by being neuroscientists, but by testing and discovering that cats activate certain neurons and dogs another one, and, you know, stories about celebrities, a whole nother series. I think when you get down to it, Jonah Peretti, who invented BuzzFeed, has always been interest at some level at the science of just making people click on stuff, no matter how weird or ridiculous or nonsensical it is. That just fascinates him. And his whole career has just been like, what can I do that might make people click?
And he was at Huffington Post, right, first. I mean,
yeah, he was one of the founders. He was one of the founders of the Huffington Post. I think Huffington Post, you know, had some noble ideas, but also pioneered clickbait when it needed to, and has really gone in some unfortunate directions.
Well, and then he came up with sort of this whole idea of, you know, how do you make stuff on the internet go viral? You know, how do you make it contagious? What did he discover?
You know, strongly linked, the clickbait and the viral content idea. He discovered through enormous amounts of experimentation that there's just some stuff that people feel compelled to forward, usually stuff that has a very arousing emotion, like you're outraged or it's hilarious or it's incredibly cute, some very basal kind of emotion that forces you almost involuntarily to think, I got to share this with my friends. And so, you know, he built a business, BuzzFeed, which is just based on trying to find that emotion, isolate it, and send it on.
And so the way clickbait works is, I mean, these companies make money just by the number of clicks and the number of shares. And it doesn't matter how long you actually spend with the content. It's just the click is the ticket to actually making money.
Right. I mean, it's an example of the metric dominating everything. People have tried to introduce other metrics, but no one's really gotten away from the click as the dominant metric. And so it's like ratings, the goal becomes maximizing it. Now, before I get too depressing on this, I think there have been some alternatives that have, in our time, that have shown more hope. But I think the metric of the click has certainly made the web what it is.
What do you see as promising points of resistance to all of this?
The Attention Merchants, my book, chronicles these long cycles of revolt. And I think we've seen the rise over the last 5 years of paid models, subscription models, by people who just can't take it anymore. And the most prominent example, frankly, is Netflix, along with HBO Go and I guess Amazon, other companies, who have started offering the opposite. The re-rise of television, kind of surprising, is a commercial free product, where as opposed to like clicking around and touching 50 things at once and coming out of it feeling like, what was that? Is you sort of sit down and you have a complete story and there's no commercial advertising and people often turn off the lights and very serious. So companies like Netflix, which have been selling the exact opposite mental state, have done very well. And I think it's a reaction, frankly, to the rise of the clickbait.
Tim Wu is the author of The Attention Merchants, the epic scramble to get inside our heads. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, when we spend time on the internet, it's entirely possible that we're not actually wasting our time at all. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There are a lot of us who worry that the amount of time we spend on the internet is doing something to us, rewiring our brains. One of the first people to really put that issue on the cultural map was the writer Nicholas Carr, in a book that's become a contemporary classic. It's called The Shallows: What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains.
Because it's all there all the time, and because we so love to be aware of everything going on around us, we short-circuit our attentiveness. When an important piece of information, whether it's text or video or whatever, comes at us, you know, rather than screening out other stuff and not paying attention to distractions and interruptions and focusing on that one important thing for a long period of time, we simply allow ourselves, because the technology is so good at it, to be constantly distracted, constantly interrupted. We glance at, you know, a new email or a new text message or a new Facebook update or a new tweet coming at us. I think the technology puts its emphasis on the gathering of information, the very fast-paced gathering of information, which is one element, certainly, in having a rich intellectual life. But it de-emphasizes and doesn't really give us any opportunity or encouragement to pay deep attention to one thing. And in fact, writing about this subject, I was originally inspired to do it from my own experience of really having problems sitting down and reading a book or a long article. And what I found is that after, you know, a couple of pages or even a couple of paragraphs, my mind got antsy and it wanted to behave the way I've trained it to behave when I'm looking at a computer screen. It didn't want to focus on one linear argument or story. It wanted to jump from page to page, to click on links, to do some Googling, to check email. I think what that shows us is how powerfully technologies can alter the way we think. And they do that by changing our habits of mind, changing our expectations. And our brains and our mind kind of adapt very well to new tools. We're very good at using them. The problem is that adaptation can be either good or bad or a mixture. And I think the loss of attentiveness, the loss of the ability to concentrate, therefore translates into a deeper loss of the ability to be contemplative and reflective and introspective. There's all sorts of very, very good things about the fact that our brains are so adaptable and so plastic and so ready to respond to changes in the environment. On the other hand, what our brains seem to be interested in is efficiency. The physical structure of our brains doesn't really make value judgments about how we think. It simply adapts to the way we use it. So if we spend all of our time juggling information and multitasking and shifting our focus very quickly, our brain optimizes itself to do that. But if we start to not pay attention, not sustain our attention on one thing, not engage in more meditative thought, our brain is very happy to begin to weaken those processes even as it strengthens the other.
Nicholas Carr is the author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. The conceptual artist Kenneth Goldsmith teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He invented a course called Uncreative Writing, and he's recently been teaching a class called Wasting Time on the Internet. Now, I have two kids in college, and I'm pretty sure that I speak for a lot of parents when I say that wasting time on the Internet is not what I hoped they would study in school. So when Goldsmith first introduced this course, it almost broke the Internet. The general response was shock, dismay, and curiosity. So now he's turned the course into a book, and Doug Gordon sat down with him to find out more.
You've been teaching a course at the University of Pennsylvania called Wasting Time on the Internet. What inspired you to create this course?
I had sort of been hearing that we've been wasting time on the Internet, and I was finding that kind of to be true and also kind of not to be true. And I wanted to kind of run an experimental course to see if, in fact, wasting time on the Internet was wasting time on the Internet truly. So I gathered 15 students. The waiting list was quite long for this class. There was a lot of attention, media attention, paid to the class before it started.
Yeah.
For a semester, basically, we just sat around a round table and wasted time together on the Internet for 3 hours a week.
Can you give me a few examples of how you all wasted time on the Internet?
The class became an incubator, an idea generator for ways that people together could waste time on the Internet. Now, that's important. Normally, when we waste time on the Internet, we waste time alone, and it feels alienating in some way. But when you put people together, mediated by machines, we found that those machines amplified emotion, amplified affect, actually made us more physical, more aware of our bodies in the space together.
Hmm. Can you give me an example, a specific example of this?
There were times in which somebody would say something, look what I found on the web, and suddenly everybody would go there, and the affect would ripple across the room. The emotion and the responses would sort of be like, but wait, look at this. Let's do this. And suddenly 1,000 ideas become generated from just one person saying something about something they're seeing on a screen to everyone else in the room.
Hmm.
And those ideas are in the back of the book. The class had compiled a list of 101 ways to waste time on the Internet.
Yeah.
It's a listicle. And there are all sorts of things. They generated thousands of ideas. Not all of them were good.
Mm.
But 101 of them are pretty good.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite or two among those 101?
One comes to mind. Post something on Instagram that violates the rules that will be taken down. Screen cap that. And when it's taken down, post the screen cap. And before that screen cap is taken down, post that screen cap and repost it until, of course, the image becomes blurred beyond recognition.
What do you think doing that accomplished for the students who did that?
I think that I would like to say that the class became like meat space social media. In other words, social media is predicated pretty much upon the way that we interact in real life, as I think much of the web is. And this class just sort of reified those notions that, in fact, technology can draw us closer together rather than the kind of typical notion that it is separating us somehow.
Mm-hmm. Kind of going against the Sherry Turkle thing, the alone together, that you can develop this collaboration and this interaction when you have a bunch of people in this sort of setting anyway and with their devices.
I mean, I get what Turkle's trying to get at, but I just don't think it's true. I think we know how to converse. I mean, as a matter of fact, we're doing both. All we're doing is conversing and communicating across these devices. I mean, they're conversational devices, even though mediated by conversation, like the telephone was. Now, are you going to tell me that a telephone call 140 years after it was invented is somehow not communicative?
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I think that face-to-face conversation happens abundantly and ubiquitously all around us all the time. So I actually don't think it's one way or the other. I think we're conversing face-to-face, and I think we're conversing mediated by technology. It's too simple.
Yeah. You've taught the course, the Wasting Time on the Internet course, what, three times, four times? Maybe more than that now.
No, actually, I'm running it now for the second time.
So the first class, what do you think your students learned from taking that course?
It's kind of hard to say. My teaching and my pedagogy go sideways.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not anti-goal-oriented, but it's not particularly goal-oriented. What it was experiential. To me, it had all the hallmarks of what a great liberal arts education should be, opening yourself up to experiences that you've never had before, ideas that you've never had before in a social situation that was structured by a lot of theory and critical reading about what we were doing.
Mm-hmm. We are living in this attention economy now. We have been for some time where we have all these different companies and different media competing for our attention. And attention's become even more of this precious commodity with the advent of the internet. Conventional wisdom says that the internet's a distraction and a waste of our time. What do you think?
I think that we need to look at modernism to find out really what we are doing in the digital age. And if we begin to look at the fractured spaces of cubism, the accelerationism of futurism, the dream spaces of surrealism, the commodification of pop art, I think we can actually find the 21st century in those 20th century experiments.
This is part of your argument, correct me if I'm wrong, that what internet critics don't understand about the internet is that it's not monolithic.
Yeah, I kind of think that my generation, the TV generation, tends to look at the internet and say, that's television.
Yeah.
Rather the way that when I was watching television in the 1960s, my father would look at us sitting there in front of the TV. You know, he was raised on radio. He'd say, when I was a kid, I had to lay on my bed and imagine what was happening in my mind. And you kids have this laid out there for you. You're lazy. What are you going to grow up to be? And of course, it all worked out fine. I think that the web is not monolithic the way that television mostly was, with seven channels. When I was a kid, things were being fed to me. The notion of choice on the web makes it fractured and more interesting. It's a diverse experience that I think we've got to learn to embrace and understand and cherish. I mean, it's much better than television.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's contradictory. We get high and low culture. We get multiple diverse things all going on at the same time.
Yeah, and the kind of notion that there are a million windows open on the desktop, for example, some showing very dry things like spreadsheets and others showing very rich things like viral videos, all happening at the same time. And somehow we're able to process that shattered space. Nobody is confused by 16 windows open on their machine.
Yeah. You say that the internet puts us in this state between deep focus and subconscious flow. Can you explain a bit about that?
André Breton, the founder of Surrealism, was interested in dream space in the midst of waking life, the unconscious. And the web sort of seems to have a lot of that in play, the sort of software. And what's below the surface that you don't see is kind of the subconscious of the web. And things bubble up into windows, becoming consciousness. And there's this divide between presence and absence, both being in front of the screen in a divided space, but also the presence and absence of kind of being there and not being there. Let's say you're in a bar with a friend and both of you have your phones out on the table and suddenly somebody gets a text and her eyes glance down onto that phone And you know what's going to happen. She's going to pick it up, say, hold on just a second. And she's going to text. And then you're probably going to, at that moment, that interval, check your mail. And then the phones go back down. You continue that conversation between the two people. I mean, this is just the way it is. And one of the problems that I have is that everybody, well, I'm not going to say everybody, but many people want to return to a time of unification, of unified attention spans, go back to reading long novels. Now, the fact is, we read long novels, but we read them on our devices. I'm reading several long novels from the 19th century right now on my iPhone. It's okay. We do both.
Getting back to this idea of André Breton and the surrealist, this continual dream state, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the surrealist's greatest wish, was to exist in this continual dream state that the web, as you were talking about just a moment ago, kind of induces in us. What are the advantages of being in a continual dream state?
Well, first of all, I mean, we're not in a continual dream state, except for opium addicts. As Breton, and really very few of the surrealists were opium addicts. It was an ideal. It was a way of letting go of drive, of letting go of ambition, of being countercultural, of opening up free spaces, as Hakim Bey so famously called them, temporary autonomous zones. And I think that the web gives us a glimpse into those temporary autonomous zones, those places that are free from necessity, very much the way that art works.
In his 2010 book, The Shallows, Nicholas Carr says that, quote, the internet is an interruption system. It seizes our attention only to scramble it, end quote. Do you agree with that?
I love that quote. I think it's brilliant, and I'm all for seizing and scrambling and making things nonsensical.
So to borrow from the old A&E TV slogan, if I can go back to a previous technology to talk about a current technology, is time on the internet time well spent?
You can't say it is one thing or it's not. Sometimes it's ill spent.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's ill spent. It's a mixture of both.
Kenneth Goldsmith is a conceptual artist and the author of Wasting Time on the Internet, the same name as the course he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He was talking with Doug Gordon. If you've ever spent any time playing Tetris, I bet you recognize that music. And if you spent any time playing Tetris, you've probably spent a lot of time playing it, because there's something weirdly addictive about it. Weird because it's just so simple. You know, these little geometric shapes keep drifting down while you try to fit them into place. But play Tetris long enough, and you'll see those Technicolor shapes everywhere, even in your dreams.
You can get into this meditative state while playing Tetris that you can't really do with other games. I spoke to a neuroscientist about Tetris, and he explained to me, like, what it does is when the first piece comes down, it creates a task in your brain. And when you place the piece, it satisfies that task. So it's a real feeling of satisfaction in your brain. And then once that piece gets played, the landscape completely changes. So you have a new problem, and then you get a new piece, and it creates a new task in your brain that you can satisfy. And it puts your brain into a place where you can think about things without feeling like you have to do something else.
Box Brown has spent a lot of time playing and thinking about Tetris. Now he's written and illustrated a graphic history of the world's most popular video game, which, who knew, turns out to have a fascinating backstory. Tetris was invented in 1984 in Soviet Russia by a Cold War computer scientist named Alexei Pajitnov, and he made it in his spare time, just for fun.
Okay, so Alexei worked in the computer center at Moscow, and he originally got into puzzles because he broke his leg. And he had this huge cast. He was in the hospital for like 5 days, and he was going to be off his feet for a long time. And friends would bring him puzzles to play. And Tetris basically existed as a game called Pentominoes, which was you would take pieces that had five blocks. Tetris is based on a four block piece, but this had five. That's why it's called Pentominoes. And, you know, you would just place them on a board like you would a regular puzzle, but if you didn't put them exactly the right way, you'd have pieces left over. And, like, that's how you would play.
So these were, like, little wooden pieces that you'd have to try to fit together.
So Alexei was playing that and thinking about it. And at the time, you know, creating something on a computer at the time was mostly about modeling it.
Like, how do I get this to look on a screen?
Right. So, but it's a unique version of pentominoes because he was picturing the pentominoes falling from the sky. And you'd have to rearrange them as they landed. And you have only a certain amount of time to manipulate them, and you have to put them in the right spot. It's like a timed version of pentominoes.
So he just invented this just for fun to see if he could. Mm-hmm. And then he does what, of course, somebody like this would do. He just starts giving it to his friends.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you write that within 2 weeks, everybody in Moscow was playing it. It somehow just spread. And this is, you know, remember, before the internet.
Right. So people, it was shareware. You know, people would put it on a little disc and hand it out to their friends, whoever. As soon as somebody would play it, imagine playing Tetris for the first time and you'd never even heard of this game. And you sit down and play it for hours. You'd be like, oh my God, this is amazing. Everybody must try this. There's a part in the book where the manager of a business gets a copy of Tetris, and he gave his whole staff copies of Tetris. And like 2 days later, he had to destroy every copy because nobody was getting any work done.
So how did Tetris go from that to being this multi-million, billion-dollar game?
Okay, so Alexei's boss at the Computer Science Center shared it with a colleague who worked at a Hungarian science center. Hungary, at the time, was already getting involved in capitalist ideas. So this guy, Robert Stein, a British investor, he came and he saw Tetris. It wasn't for sale, but they just happened to have it in the background there. And he started playing it and he couldn't put it down. And
so he had the magical Tetris effect.
Right. So he thought to himself, you know, I'm terrible at video games. And this is the guy who owns the company. He was like, I'm terrible at video games, but I can't stop playing this. So there must be something to it. So he contacted Alexei directly and was trying to gain the rights. In that exchange, Robert Stein believed that he had bought the rights to Tetris. Alexei had believed that he had said, okay, let's talk.
Uh-oh.
So at that point, Stein just goes all out, starts selling the rights to Tetris. A British version comes out for the computer. An American version comes out for the computer. They win awards. They're selling a lot.
So at some point, does somebody say, hey, Alexei, that game you invented is for sale all over the world?
Yeah. So, you know, the Japanese had bought the rights to Tetris and made a Nintendo version, and they wanted to make the handheld version. They had invented the Game Boy, and they thought Tetris would be perfect for this. And it was in the exploring of making sure that they had the handheld rights to Tetris that the Russians really found out that they had something going here.
I spell out exactly what happened, because this one guy,
Hank Rogers,
he winds up essentially crashing this government
agency. So Hank Rogers was now Bulletproof Software and representing Nintendo. Okay. So he has a lot on the line. But Hank Rogers needs to get these rights, the handheld rights to Tetris. So he just goes straight to Moscow. Went to Elorg, was the name of the government agency that owned Tetris.
And this is Cold War.
Right.
Soviet
Which
Union,
is, it
Russia.
It took him forever even to find the building. And his translator wouldn't even go in with him because she didn't know what even could happen just for going into a government building without an appointment or anything like that. And Gorbachev and government higher-ups are now paying attention to Belikov, the guy who's doing these negotiations. And he could have been punished in a way.
In fact, didn't the KGB come around and sort of say, you better get this right?
Right. So these are high, high stakes for him, too.
Huh. Now, while all of this was happening, you mentioned Gorbachev. So around this time was like Ronald Reagan met Gorbachev for the first time. Was part of the mystique of Tetris that it came from Russia?
Yeah. At first, they didn't know how to sell it in America. What they ended up doing was making it seem like something sinister that escaped the Iron Curtain. Reagan and Gorbachev had now started talking, and there was these closed-door meetings. So when they first brought Tetris to America, one of the things they did was they took out a huge ad in the newspaper, and it was like, well, what are they really doing behind these closed doors? And it was like two people that looked like Gorbachev and Reagan playing Tetris.
Oh, my gosh.
That was the ad.
Well, meanwhile, what about Alexei sitting back there in Moscow just going to his day job day after day? Did he see any profit on this?
Not for a long time. During the entire run with Nintendo, they sold 90 million copies of the Game Boy cartridge. You know, Alexei was not getting money from that because it would go to the government. So, you know, we think about this whole idea of him not making all this money as like the big tragedy of Tetris, right? The creator doesn't make any money. Now, he does now own the rights and has for the last 20 years. What happened was Hank Rogers... Hank, who had gotten the rights to Tetris for Nintendo, had become friends with Alexei. And so Hank helped Alexei get the rights for Tetris, for himself and for Hank. Now, then they formed the Tetris company, and they moved to the U.S.
Hmm.
Alexei got a job at Microsoft making games. So he's probably doing fine. But the thing that I always say is that he gained something way more important than that. And that's that he found his medium. He's a game maker. He's an artist. That's what's really important.
It's so interesting because Tetris looks almost primitive today by comparison to the games that we have. And games have gotten so gorgeous.
Sure.
And, you know, and here's Tetris, this old-fashioned thing with these little multicolored blocks. And yet it sounds like you still think it's one of the best games ever made.
Yeah, I think of Tetris as, like, part of the canon of video games. And I don't think it's exaggerating to say that it is like the Mona Lisa of video games or, you know, the Statue of David. I mean, these are iconic canon things that led people to make other things. You know, it's part of the lineage of games. The other thing is that we tend to think that once a new system comes out or a new way of making graphics or whatever it is, we tend to look back at the old games as inferior. I don't think that's true, though. I mean,
right. Why don't we think of them as classic?
Right. It would be like looking back at a painting and saying that's totally inferior because we've now invented photography. You know, yeah, that's. I think of it in that way as a, say, classic thing. And if you picked it up today, you'd have just as much fun playing it as you did in 1989 or whatever.
That's Box Brown talking about his new graphic history book, Tetris, The Games People Play. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Mark Rickers. Thanks to guest engineer Brittany Williams. Our theme music is from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.